Поэтому,
what would you expect
если, НАТО,
if NATO is essentially engaged in a war with Russia through a proxy or arms this proxy? Being at war is being at war.
На войне как на войне.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov speaking to Russian state TV last month, raising the stakes on the conflict his country started by invading Ukraine, calling it a proxy war between Russia and NATO. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki pushed back on that characterization on Monday.
This is not a proxy war. I know that is the Republican, I mean the Russian talking point on this, but it is not a proxy war. This is a war between Russia and Ukraine. NATO is not involved. The United States is not fighting this war, so I think it's important and vital for all of us to not repeat the Kremlin talking points on this front.
It may not be a proxy war in the strictest sense, but could this morph into a veiled U.S.-Russia conflict? Olivier Knox has looked into this. He writes the Daily 202 newsletter for The Washington Post. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Well, let's talk about what Lavrov said there. Why did he call it a proxy war? What's the motivation there?
Well, there are a couple of schools of thought on this. One is that it helps Russia hide the extent of their battlefield failures against a Ukrainian military that all experts thought would be wildly overmatched and quickly defeated. So one way you explain the loss of all these tanks, the loss of all these planes, the loss of all this ground, the loss of all these troops is to say, well, we're not really losing to Ukraine. We're actually losing to NATO and the United States. That's one school of thought. The other school of thought is, at several turns in this conflict, Russia's tried to escalate things. You know, they put their nuclear forces on alert, at least rhetorically on alert. U.S. officials say they haven't seen any major shifts in how they're actually deployed. They've rattled the nuclear saber in the last couple of weeks. And so for a home audience, sometimes that is also appealing. The idea is that Russia is big and strong and will not be intimidated by the outside world.
But didn't the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, didn't he say that one of the aims on the part of the U.S. is to see Russia's military weakened? So wouldn't that also give fuel to this idea that this is a proxy war?
Yeah. So when I dug into this, when I wrote my column about whether or not this is a proxy war, I actually came to the column with the thinking that it is a proxy war and I'll need to be shown that it's not. With Lloyd Austin now suggesting this broader geopolitical goal, it certainly started to feel more to me like we were getting into proxy war territory. Whether we are or not, the experts I spoke to said we're not, because what we're doing is supporting Ukrainian battlefield goals. We're not. It's not like the U.S. instigated this conflict. It's not like the U.S. has what one of my experts said it was a screw the Soviets kind of strategy. But because the United States is supporting the Ukrainians as they try to recapture their sovereignty.
What are the parallels, though, with Afghanistan a few decades ago? A 10-year-long war there, Russia in Afghanistan, the U.S. backing the Mujahideen. Is that similar?
Well, it is similar, but that policy was rather explicitly contrived to bleed the Soviet Union. Right, we didn't really have an end stage of what we wanted to see in Afghanistan, other than we wanted Soviet troops to die, and so the argument there is that that's closer to being a proxy war. You know, one of the definitions though is pitting proxy versus proxy, so it's closer in say 1980s Nicaragua when the United States is when the Soviet Unions are funding the Sandinistas, and the U.S. is funding the Contras. There you have sort of a proxy versus a proxy. That's a lot closer to the definition.
And why do we care if it's called a proxy war or not?
Well, you know, one of the things that worries a lot of American officials is that one day Vladimir Putin's going to get up and say, you know what, NATO's really involved in this war, and therefore NATO targets are fair game. They're providing weapons that are being used to kill Russians in Ukraine. And that, of course, has massive escalatory risks because NATO's centerpiece is Article 5, the Mutual Defense Pact. It says an attack on one is an attack on all. And so that's one reason to be concerned about it. The other, I think, is just generally if the theory that this is to explain their battlefield defeats is correct, then what you're seeing and what President Biden alluded to when he was asked this question about whether it's a proxy war is that it indicates a level of desperation on the Russian part. And as they get more concerned, as their battlefield aims change, American officials and NATO officials and Ukrainians are all worried that the more desperate they get, the more likely the Russians are to, say, use a chemical weapon. Mm-hmm. And so those are reasons to be concerned.
Right. But I guess semantics aside, if Russia believes it and Russia acts on it, does it matter if we say it is a proxy war or not? I mean, we are supplying weapons and intelligence. And just yesterday we learned the U.S. provided intelligence that helped Ukraine kill a dozen top Russian generals. So I guess, how would you define proxy in that way? And does it really matter if Russia sees the U.S. as having a heavy hand in this and then reacts, or NATO, then does it even matter if we think it's a proxy war or not?
Well, I mean, if we agree publicly that it's a proxy war, then we're encouraging a Russian escalation. So it matters in that sense. But no, broadly speaking, what matters is what's happening on the ground, the immense human suffering. That's what matters. You know, it's a little bit like the debates over whether American politicians need to say that that we were at war with radical Islamic terrorism. You know, I had one very senior career intel official who told me, look, are you guys under the impression that that an American drone kills people differently if we use that phrase? No, it does not. So it's sort of similar here. It does matter to a degree, but it's obviously not the main thing.
Okay, so given that, what do your experts that you interviewed say is the likelihood that Russia will widen this and attack NATO targets or attack outside the borders of Ukraine?
The people I've talked to don't think that that's going to happen. The people I've talked to see escalation as being chiefly an in-theater thing, with one exception, and that exception is cyber. They think, because the United States has never made it very clear whether a cyber attack could result in a traditional military response, and because both China and Russia have carried out fairly aggressive cyber attacks on the West in the past, they think that's the one outside of Ukraine's border escalatory move that Moscow still has and might still play. I mean, we've some piecemeal reports of Russian cyber attackers going after the Baltics, going after Poland, going after other spots, but they don't imagine a MiG bombing a target inside Poland. Now, obviously, the other big weapon that Moscow has, and they recently decided to use it, was reining in energy exports to Europe, to Poland, to places like Poland. They could do the same for Italy. They could do the same for Germany. There are all kinds of ways that they could leverage their energy wealth, natural gas and oil, to inflict a lot of economic pain. But obviously, that is also very, very different from having a MiG drop a bomb inside of Poland.
Right. Or using a nuclear weapon.
Right. Also not a likely thing. What we know, just because of what we've seen in Syria, the chemical weapon route is much more likely. I should amend something I said earlier, which is that the other possible escalatory move outside of Ukraine's borders is in a country that is not in NATO.
Olivier Knox from The Washington Post. He writes their daily 202 newsletter. Olivier, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Whether the U.S. is fighting a proxy war or not, it's costing a lot of money. Last week, President Biden requested $33 billion from Congress for weapons, ammunition, and economic assistance to Ukraine. That's on top of the $14 billion already granted in March.
The cost of this fight is not cheap, but caving to aggression is going to be more costly if we allow it to happen. We either back Ukrainian people as they defend their country, or we stand by as the Russians continue their atrocities and aggression in Ukraine.
Biden's $33 billion request has bipartisan support, but should it face more scrutiny? We're going to talk about that now with Bill Hartung, senior fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Welcome to Press Play.
Yes, thanks for having me.
All right, so that would be a total of $47 billion. That we have spent in the last couple of months, that we will have spent in the last few months since the invasion. Can you put that into perspective in terms of how we have funded other wars?
Well, yes. If you look at Afghanistan, the most we ever sent there in terms of security assistance to their military was less than half of what we're sending to Ukraine this year. So this is the largest package in living memory, certainly in the last two decades, which was, you know, that included the Iraq and Afghan war. So it's a huge military commitment. And this is only for the next 5 months. There could be another emergency supplemental in the fall that would add to that $47 billion that you already talked about.
Wow. So when you're talking about Afghanistan, you're talking about per year, because obviously the total cost.
Yes,
more
per year. Of course. I mean, God forbid we go for 20 years in Ukraine. But yes, that was per year.
Why so much money in such a short period of time? What's costing so much?
Well, it's because it's all weapons and increasingly heavier weapons. So in Afghanistan, there was money spent on building military bases, logistics, paying the soldiers. So a smaller percentage of it was just the guns and ammo piece of it. Whereas Ukraine, that is the primary kind of expenditure. And so that's part of it. And also because it's a war involving a major power. And so it's a more, weapon intensive kind of warfare than we saw in Afghanistan.
And when it comes to buying these weapons, are they essentially buying weapons from American manufacturers? So is this money going back into the American economy in a way?
Eventually it will. In the short term, a lot of it came out of military stocks. So it's going straight there, sometimes taking as little as 72 hours to get to Ukraine. But that'll all be replenished. So there'll be a round of contracts to U.S. companies like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon to replace Stinger missiles, anti-tank missiles, eventually howitzers and other items, drones that are being sent. So there'll be kind of a cascading effect. There'll also be, NATO allies will start buying more weapons, many of them from U.S. companies. And they'll use this as an argument to increase the Pentagon's regular budget. So this is a potential bonanza for U.S. Arms contractors.
Right. I guess they must be lobbying in favor of this bill.
Well, if they need to. I mean, there's not much opposition. So they may not, they would be pushing on an open door. But they may well be lobbying for higher top line for the Pentagon, which would be in addition to these emergency funds that are just for Ukraine and Europe.
How much of this package is going to humanitarian assistance?
Well, on this round, about $20 billion of the $33 is military related, either to replenish stocks or for military aid or to put more troops in Europe or to sell to European allies. So so about $13 billion is humanitarian in one form or another.
And then I guess there will have to be more expenditures to rebuild Ukraine when this war finally ends, if it ends.
Yes, there'll be immense expenditures at the end of the war for rebuilding. And some people have said, given the kind of corruption we saw in the rebuilding of Afghanistan, perhaps we need a special inspector general here to keep tabs on all this, to make sure money isn't wasted and that it's as effective as possible in helping the people of Ukraine.
Well, who is overseeing this money now?
It's kind of flowing out the door. I mean, Secretary Blinken said, basically it's up to the Ukrainian military to figure out what happens with these billions and billions of weapons that we're sending there. Some of them are small arms and ammunition, which are easily transferred in or out of country. So there's a danger as the war winds down, some of these weapons could end up in other war zones around the world.
And that has happened in other conflicts, as we've seen in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, in the original U.S. arming of the Mujahideen, some of them went on, took their arms and became part of Al-Qaeda. So there's definitely dangers of the fact that these weapons outlast whatever specific political or military situation they're supplied to deal with.
And does this spending request also include requests for training? And we just talked in the previous segment about a possible proxy war or an escalation of the U.S. involvement. Would this kind of spending package encourage a kind of widening of U.S. involvement in this war?
Well, the training is going to get ramped up because the kinds of weapons that are being sent now are not ones that the Ukrainian military has normally worked with. So a lot of that, hopefully all of it, will be done out of country in places like Germany, sometimes even in the United States. But I think as the training increases, as the intelligence sharing increases, as the level of weaponry transferred becomes more capable, there is a danger of escalation. And, it doesn't matter whether it's a proxy war. A lot of it has to do with how it's perceived by Putin. And we don't have a lot of control over that, but I think we have to be mindful that at some point just huge quantities of weaponry could have increased the danger of U.S.-Russian confrontation that would be more direct. And of course, that you don't want that between two nuclear-armed powers.
Right. What kind of debate are you seeing on Capitol Hill or elsewhere over this and over the spending request?
Well, I'd like to see more scrutiny. Are we sending the right things? What's going to be the impact, both budgetarily and in terms of the risk of escalation? I haven't seen a lot of that on the Hill. I think some of the debate will be partisan. You know, should they have an emergency package that includes COVID aid as well as Ukraine aid? And will Republicans block that? And will some Republicans say this still isn't enough? I mean, I think no matter what President Biden does, there's going to be this isn't enough kind of argument being made. But I don't think any of the people saying that, at least people of sound mind, are saying we should put, you know, troops in Ukraine or do a no-fly zone that would involve shooting down Russian planes. So I think some of this is political theater. But I think nonetheless, this package deserves maybe a more careful look than it may get, given the, you know, just the tenor of the public mood about all the atrocities that Russia is committing in Ukraine.
Yeah, and there's a limited pool of taxpayer money. So if you're spending billions on Ukraine and not spending billions on COVID relief, that's a decision.
Exactly. And, you know, this year alone, the Ukraine aid is going to be three times or more the budget of the Centers for Disease Control. So there's really, you know, when there's scarce money, some of that money can go a long way in saving lives in different ways. So it's something to be, I think, discussed, especially if we're getting one package after another going forward.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Hartung, Senior Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Coming up, the drought is having an unequal effect here in California, how Black farming communities are struggling to find enough water for basic necessities. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California is drying up. We are in a historic drought, and we'll face unprecedented restrictions here in Southern California beginning next month. In the Central Valley, some residents are used to having little water. It's been that way for decades. And these are mainly poor Black and Latino families whose communities were not allowed to use water from nearby cities. Well, they're fighting back now. David Bacon wrote about the unequal access to water for the nation, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. Well, first, help us understand, who are the people in these communities? How many people live in what are being called the colonias?
Well, Bill Manning, who just recently got termed out as the Speaker of the Assembly, told me that there are about 1 million Californians who live in 130 communities across the state who are living in what I guess you would call communities of excluded people. And these are communities that generally were established by African-Americans who came up from the South in two waves. The first one right after World War I and the second one right after World War II. And when people came up from the South, they faced racial exclusion by the cities in the Central Valley, every cities from Fresno or Visalia or Tulare. Here you have people who were working the cotton as sharecroppers in the South and who came up to California when cotton was a big crop in the valley here. And because they couldn't live in towns like Tulare, for instance, they set up settlements on the periphery of those cities. So you have a community like Matheny Tract, which was set up on the outskirts of Tulare, or you have one called Lanier that was set up on the outskirts of Riverdale. And these were communities of exclusion, people who were not able to buy property. And as a result, the cities really that had excluded them did not provide any services. There was no water, there were no sewer services. So really people had to find all of these things for themselves. And that's the origin of the water crisis in these tiny communities today.
And are these tiny communities still mainly African-American?
There are still a very significant number of African-American people that live in some of these communities. And some of them, like Teveston, for instance, are still very much a majority African-American community. But the number of African-Americans living in those communities has gone down, and they've become communities where primarily the people who live there are farm workers, Mexican farm workers. So Mexican farm workers are in some ways inheriting the conditions that were imposed on African-American people when those communities were first started.
So I understand that they were excluded from the cities in terms of providing services, but why doesn't the county then step in and provide these services?
Well, that's a very good question. Why didn't the counties do that? I think that the counties, here we're talking about, you know, who has power really and who doesn't. And these exclusions by the cities were done by those land interests, primarily growers, but the people who really controlled the land in the cities and the counties. And they were also the powers that be, not just on the city council of a city like Tulare, but on the board of supervisors of the county of Tulare. It was really the same group of people who were responsible for writing those exclusions. So the counties were really not about to undo what the cities were doing, because really it was the same group of people who were responsible for the exclusions in both levels.
And so how do they get their water and how do they take care of their sewage?
People had the money to only dig relatively shallow wells. And so when people dug those shallow wells, the water that they were pulling up was already contaminated by the chemicals that were in the soil. And then of course, these are communities that are surrounded by fields. And so what the growers were doing to make the land productive for themselves, in other words, they were using fertilizers and they were using pesticides, those chemicals also wound up in the water table. And so people were pulling up out of these shallow wells water that was already contaminated. But as the years went on, the water level in the Central Valley has dropped. And that's primarily the result of overpumping for irrigation by growers. And so on the one hand, part of the problem was the contamination of the water. And on the other hand, it was also the fact that increasingly those wells were not able to supply the water needs of the people who lived there.
So when that happened, and relatively recently, right, last summer, you write about a town going an entire month without water. When that happened, where did they get their water?
Some cases, you know, these were water crises and water emergencies. So the counties and the state might have stepped in some cases, for instance, to supply towns with bottled water. That happened in Teveston, which is right next to Highway 99. It happened in Tombstone Territory, which is right next to Sanger. And the city of Porterville basically supplied people with drinking water. But you can imagine that getting your water in those big 5-gallon bottles, you know, that's enough water perhaps to cook with, and it's enough water to drink. But what about taking a shower? What about cleaning yourself and your children? I mean, it's not really, you know, those were emergency measures that were taken, and they certainly highlighted and they dramatized the extreme crisis that's been developing here. But certainly supplying these communities with bottled water was no answer really to the water needs of those communities.
Right. And so has the state stepped in and tried to come up with a solution?
Well, yes, but I wouldn't exactly say that the state stepped in. What happened was that these communities got organized and they had some help. And so they began, first of all, suing the communities that were next to them to try to, you know, force them to make connections to the municipal water systems. And then they increasingly began going to Sacramento and getting and putting pressure on legislators in Sacramento to pass legislation that would help them.
Well, I wonder, though, because we are in this drought and there we are talking about water rationing in many parts of the state, if that is just adding to the tension that these cities don't want to share their water when we're in such a water crisis.
Well, yes. I think you're pointing to the larger context, which is, first of all, affecting everybody, in this case, in the Central Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley. And that is that we have drought conditions. We've had a drought declaration off and on since, 2014. As a result of that, there are, every county is required to come up with a groundwater resource plan. So this is a situation in which we're talking about priorities. In other words, who has the priority on water usage? And historically, in the Central Valley and California in general, the priority goes to agriculture. Agriculture in California uses 77% of all the water that is used by human beings in the state of California. That's an enormous percentage. That means that the 8.5 million acre feet of water is what goes to Los Angeles, San Francisco, and the colonias and the cities of the Central Valley. So everybody is in this situation here of drought, of climate change. I don't think there's really anybody that believes that all of a sudden, you know, there's going to be more water from somewhere. And so the water has to be parceled out in a socially just way. And that, I think, is a part of what is going on here with the colonias as they push for a more equitable distribution of the water that is available.
That's David Bacon. You can read his reporting on the water crisis in the nation. And he's the author of many books, including the latest, which has just been published. It's called More Than a Wall, Más que un Muro. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews. There's a new Marvel movie out and also Marmaduke.
This is a movie that is made for little kids. It is not made for little kids to enjoy. It's made for little kids to sort of endure, presumably so that later on when they see better movies, they'll have something to compare it to.
Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now to talk about new movies and, of course, another weekend, another Marvel movie. William Bibbiani is here. He's film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Hi there.
Hello.
And Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the podcast Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong. Welcome back.
So glad to be back, Madeline, and to see Bibbs, one of my faves.
Yay. So glad to have you both.
One of my faves too. Yay.
Okay. Stop the mushiness. All right. Let's talk about yet another Marvel movie, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Elizabeth Olsen.
You think there will be no consequences? We're in the endgame now.
I sacrificed everything. And it meant nothing.
Oh, Strange. What have you done?
All right, Jacqueline, Elizabeth Olsen plays Wanda Maximoff in the WandaVision TV series. Here she is in this multiverse. I'm confused already, so can you give us a Doctor Strange for Dummies primer?
Oh, God bless me. Here we go. I will just say, so this is the MCU's latest outing, and what it is in this next phase is these new films very much weave into the television shows. And so WandaVision, at the end of that, when we had Elizabeth Olsen, you know, sort of reeling from the depression and loss of vision, essentially morphing through the course of that show and then into this film into more of a villain-like character as she attempts to try and find her children and a semblance of peace after the events of Endgame. And along for the ride in that is Benedict Cumberbatch playing Doctor Strange again and Sochi Gomez playing America Chavez, who is the new character that is able to jump from place to place within this multiverse, because with Sam Raimi, director of Spider-Man and so many incredible films before this, he's really bringing this sort of multiverse thing that we saw in Spider-Man No Way Home into the fabric of the MCU with this one, and he's doing it on a trippy, psychedelic acid trip of a movie, and I had an incredible time on the journey with him.
You loved it.
I really did enjoy this one. I am not in any way going to pretend that it does not have some warts. It is very much a style over substance endeavor. But when the style is Sam Raimi and Evil Dead callbacks and just the most metal movie I've ever seen in the MCU, sign me up.
Metal? How is it metal?
Yes. I don't know how to explain to you, but it is.
Okay. Bibbs, what did you think?
I think I grew up with a different kind of metal than Jacqueline. I wasn't a huge fan of this one. I think it's entertaining. I think I had a decent enough time with it. The story is thin, even for Marvel standards. It's basically an excuse for a series of set pieces, about two or three of which are genuinely really weird and memorable in a way that perhaps only Sam Raimi could have pulled off. There's one action sequence involving music, which I've never seen before, and I thought that was really cool. But a lot of it is actually a bit of a missed opportunity in terms of how much we're planning to sort of dive into this multiverse and how little we actually do there. That's kind of a disappointment. I also think that if you're a fan of WandaVision, your mileage might really vary as to how successful a follow-up you think this is. Personally, I feel as though the movie kind of betrays the story arc that we were given in WandaVision. So for me, it's a huge mixed bag. The cool stuff is cool enough that I do think it's worth seeing if you're an MCU fan, but I don't think this is going to be one of those like crossover Spider-Man No Way Home things that hits every single thing just right. It doesn't have all those great emotional beats. Mm-hmm. It is just an excuse for neat stuff to happen, but neat stuff does happen. So we'll give it that.
But Sam Raimi's a horror guy, right? So is there horror in this?
There is actually some, there's definitely some horror elements in here where he treats it more like a horror movie. He is still hindered by what is possible in a PG-13 MCU universe. But I will say this much, he got away with more than I thought he would. There's definitely some weird violence in here that pushes the limit of a PG-13 pretty hard.
All right. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is in theaters in wide release beginning today. Next up, a Finnish horror film. It's called The Twin.
Come on. Nu går du. Okay, så får du ut da.
Nei!
Stop!
Adam! Stop!
Stop! Ooh, okay. There's a lot going on here. A guy is getting knocked out on a boat. We hear some water sounds there. Jacqueline, what's happening?
Yeah, so The Twin is basically, I think, a revamp of a Finnish legend, which basically talks about a haunted twin. In the film, we follow Teresa Palmer. You guys will recognize her from Warm Bodies, and she plays a mother of a former twin set where they have lost one twin. And this idea of being haunted by twin imagery is really the conceit of this horror film. So in the time frame that they choose to, this family moves from New York back to Finland because the father in the family is from Finland. And in doing so, they end up on a wide open pasture farmland with lots of occult and religious imagery. And those two forces definitely coincide. It has a lot of, you know, Rosemary's Baby type elements to it. And I would just say better horror tropes that have been employed elsewhere more successfully sort of mushed into this, which is kind of a disappointment because the first film by this director, Mosnin, if I'm saying that wrong, I apologize, but his first film, Lake Barrel, was amazing, and this is just really a bad echo with a lot of the same folks coming back.
Ooh, a bad twin, an evil twin of a movie.
Exactly.
All right, Bibbs, what did you think?
I think I liked it a little bit more than Jacqueline. This is the kind of movie where you see the setup for this. It's, you know, oh, there's a horrible accident. One of the twins dies and they take their surviving child off to this creepy house where there's a lot of mystery. And if you've seen movies like this, if you're a fan of this genre of horror film, you're saying to yourself, okay, which of the five twist endings is this going to have? Oh, number four. Okay, cool. Thank you for this. I think they save it with a judicious application of genuinely creepy style. I think Teresa Palmer is able to carry this material very well. I usually don't get to see performances raw from her here. Reminds me of her performance in Lights Out, which is also very good. So this movie is okay, but it's definitely not doing anything new, exciting, or profound with the genre. It's just kind of an adequate genre exercise.
Okay, The Twin, in select theaters and streaming beginning tomorrow. Next up, an animated film on Netflix, Marmaduke, with characters voiced by Pete Davidson and J.K. Simmons.
We have to do something about Marmaduke.
He's a handful. Marmaduke has gone viral.
A dog like this is impossible to train, even for the world's greatest dog trainer, Guy Hilton.
I can turn your dog into a champion.
Okay, Bibbs, you have the pleasure of seeing this movie. Jacqueline, so sorry for you that you missed this one. Bibbs, tell us more.
Okay, you know, never let anyone tell you that being a film critic is easy. Marmaduke is a new animated film from Netflix that has all of the flash and aesthetic you would expect from a student project at an animation school. It is actually very shoddily put together. The character designs are very bizarre. The plot makes no sense. It's about how this guy is gonna, like, I'm gonna prove I can train the world's worst dog, and he does it okay, and it's like, cool, I guess. This is a movie that is made for little kids. It is not made for little kids to enjoy. It's made for little kids to sort of endure, presumably so that later on when they see better movies, they'll have something to compare it to.
So actually, they're doing a service.
Just because it's made for kids doesn't mean we have to forgive everything. This is a poor film. Pete Davidson can be very funny. He's not here. J.K. Simmons has won an Oscar. You wouldn't know it from here. And the animation is of distractingly low quality, and the writing isn't good.
Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the play?
It turns out the Owen Wilson Marmaduke was the good one. Who knew?
Okay, Marmaduke, if you are a masochist, is streaming on Netflix. Next up, L'Evenement, or Happening. It's a French film that is especially timely this week. It's an adaptation of Annie Ernaux's novel about a young woman's experience with abortion when it was illegal in France in the 1960s.
Tu peux pas nous faire une maladie maintenant? Vous êtes enceinte, mademoiselle.
This is actually based on true events. A doctor tells this young woman she's pregnant. She responds, that's not possible. All right, Bibbs, start us off. Seems like the timing here is impeccable.
Yeah, so Happening takes place at a time when, well, everything seems kind of idyllic for this young woman. She's in college. She's got her whole future ahead of her. And then when it turns out that she's pregnant because of an oppressive legal system that doesn't care whatsoever about women's bodily autonomy, she has very few options available to her. And this is about her pursuit to have an abortion so that she can live her life. And there's a ticking clock on this. There are people around her who refuse to have so much as a conversation about it. There are doctors who actively betray her. It is basically showing how, and this could not be more relevant, living in a society where abortion is illegal is, for women, living in the kind of dystopian hellscape that for men only seems to exist in like sci-fi novels like 1984. It is absolutely riveting. It is uncompromising. It is unflinching. It is incredibly direct with how it handles the topic. It doesn't dance around it. It's too early to say it's one of the best films of the year because it's like not a year isn't even half over. But if we get 10 better films than this, I'll be very impressed. This is incredible, and it would have been incredible last week. But this week, it's not only incredible, I think it's a must see.
And just as a backgrounder, France legalized abortion in 1975. And so a couple years after Roe v. Wade. Jacqueline.
Yeah, I can't talk enough about this film and how gripping and moving it was. I think the very first time I saw it was at Sundance this past year. And the thing I think is incredible about it is when I got struck by it is how much I believe this book that this is based off of has been, I would say, the Bible of so many other stories similar to this, in the sense that you can tell in the adaptation of things like Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, elements of this story and essentially how they choose to tell these women's stories through these moments are the same. I was called back to all these films like Little Woods and just, yeah, the realities of showing, I think, authentically in cinema, these moments that happen every day it's really incredible. And I'm not at all surprised it's one of the highest rated films on our site currently. And people can't stop talking about how timely it is.
Hmm. Right. And there haven't really been a lot of abortion movies, right? Or movies that explicitly are centered around abortion.
Yeah, I think in the pantheon, we have way less. But really recently, we have things like, I tweeted about it the other day just to sort of say, like, hey, if you want to go watch some of these films, there's been a few. We had Unplanned from HBO Max, Never Really, Sometimes Always, Little Woods.
Which is great, yeah.
Yeah, Obvious Child. There's been a few, actually, recently. What's been interesting is whereas then The Happening is really centered specifically around that. I think in film, it's maybe a part of the narrative, but these are films where that is the drama. That is the story, yeah. This woman's struggle to have body autonomy.
Right. I mean, I remember Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and that is a plot point, but it is not the plot point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the way they handled it seemed incredibly real without hyping it on in either direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Happening in theaters beginning tomorrow. Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes and co-host of the podcast Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. William Bibbiani, film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining me now is Steve Chiatakis with a preview of Greater LA, which is coming up in about 12 minutes from now.
Minutes from now. And you know how a lot of young people say, you know, the future is bright, or maybe older people tell the younger people, your future is bright, you have so much ahead of you. And then they look at climate change and they look at the earth warming and the oceans rising and everything else, and maybe the future is not so bright. And there are a lot of climate activists who are young saying, hey, we want the world to know. We need adults to take action, and we're going to talk about them coming up on the show in just a few minutes.
All right. The future is bright because in 10 minutes or so, Greater LA is coming up. So thank you, Steve.
All right, Madeline.
Coming up, happy Cinco de Mayo. Evan Kleinman is here with recommendations for a taco crawl. So don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, it is Cinco de Mayo, the day in 1862 when Mexico defeated the French. But you're forgiven if you don't know that, because in this country, it's mainly an excuse to drink beer and eat tacos. Joining us now, as always, is Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, here to tell us about her idea for a taco crawl. Hi.
Hi.
Is that like a beer crawl, but with tacos instead?
I think all food and drink crawls mean going from one place to another, kind of like a progressive meal. Probably it started with beer, which is where the crawling came in.
Yeah, because you've had so much beer, you can't stand up. Yeah. Which is sometimes how I feel when I eat too many tacos. I have to lie down.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's true.
Okay. So what is your ideal taco crawl?
So it's really interesting. I mean, pretty much every time I have somebody visiting from out of town, I'll take them on a taco crawl. But it usually involves driving all over the city to places I've chosen. And I was trying to think of a way to do it where you only had to park your car once. Mm-hmm. And I hit on the fabulous Mercado La Paloma in historic South Central near USC. It's a really interesting place. It was created as a project of the Esperanza Community Housing Organization as a way to preempt the kind of development that happens where residents who actually live in the area can't really patronize the businesses. So this was a huge community project that resulted in a food hall that's also has different kinds of shops. And then upstairs, there is all this space for nonprofits to meet. So it's really a lovely, engaging place.
It is. And it's so, I don't know, it's just a nice place to hang out in. It's well appointed.
Yes, definitely. And there's a ton of parking.
Yeah, also a benefit here in LA. Okay, so which of the taco joints in the Mercado La Paloma do you recommend?
So first, we're going to start with something on the lighter side, just to tee ourselves up, from Whole Box, which is the seafood-focused stand that's there from Gilberto Cetina. And we're going to get a scallop taco, just one. You're going to be standing there. You're going to want to order everything on the menu, but this is a crawl. You're just going to have that one scallop taco.
Okay, restraint. And why the scallop?
Because it's extraordinary. It's a Maine diver scallop, so it's just a beautiful quality. And the way he layers the flavors with that scallop is just really beautiful.
All right, a scallop taco, just one, from Hall
Box. Just one.
All right, number two?
Number two, we head over to Taqueria Vista Hermosa, where Raul Morales is a multi-generational pastor maker. He learned in Michoacán, where he grew up helping his uncle, who was a master. And in his family, he represents the third generation making tacos al pastor. And those two tacos sort of set us up for the main event, as it were.
Okay, the main event is number three?
Yeah, the main event, you might think number three would be dessert, but no, it's a three-in-one. We're going to Chichen Itza, Chef Raul Cetina, where you can get the Trio Yucateco, which includes a cochinita pibil taco, one of my favorite kinds of tacos. Cochinita pibil is a Yucatecan pork braise where it's braised in achiote and traditionally Seville oranges. It's just such a delicious way of making meat. But then we're also going to have the salbute. We're going to have a salpute and a panuncho, which are super traditional Yucatecan taco-like items. But they're not tacos.
What are they?
So panunchos and salputes are very traditional Yucatecan masa-based treats. They're slightly different than a taco. Panunchos are made from a disc of masa, like you're going to make a regular tortilla, but then it's fried, it's deep fried. And what that does is it causes the tortilla to puff up, which allows the cook to slit it open, much like a pita bread. And then they're stuffed with black bean puree, lettuce, shredded turkey, pickled red onions, and a slice of avocado. Then the cousin to a panucho is more like a taco. It's a salpute. And they also begin with a tortilla, this time not fried. And then it is topped kind of like a tostada, but it's not a hard shell. And it's also topped with shredded lettuce and turkey and then garnished with the pickled red onions, tomatoes, and a slice of avocado. They're so delicious. And you can't get them in many places.
Okay, so I don't think anyone's going to be hungry after this, but let's say you want something else, just a little something-something. What do you suggest?
Laying down and waiting till that passes.
Okay.
What I would do this time of year, actually, is I would get in my car and drive myself over, or walk, because I just ate all that stuff, over to Exposition Park and sit in the Rose Garden, because the blooms are fabulous this time of year.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So, yeah. All right. A lovely way to spend the day. Celebrate tacos, Cinco de Mayo, smell the roses. What is on Good Food this weekend?
It's our Mother's Day show. For the past few months, we've been asking authors that we interview to tell us stories about their mothers and food. So we have a lovely montage with several voices. And I also interviewed production designer and prop master for Pachinko, the series on Apple TV, which is just fascinating because it's a multi-generational story that takes place in Korea and in Japan. And you follow this one family, and of course, there is a lot of food, which has a lot of meaning.
Yeah. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, Saturday mornings at 11 or wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, Evan, love you and I hate you. I hate you because you always make me hungry. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you for listening to KCRW and to Press Play. We are in our spring fundraising season, so we're keeping our pitches to breaks only right now. So give now. Get it done now. It's got a low pain threshold for fundraising right now at kcrw.com/give. Our producers on Press Play are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Marcel Hutchins. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our marvelous managing producer. And our technical director is Super Mario Saavedra. Phil Richards also engineered this week. I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you so much for being part of our listening audience on Press Play. Don't forget, kcrw.com/give. I'll see you on Monday.